What are the tiny things that can undermine your connection to others, especially your partner? While they may seem innocuous or be downright obvious, once you learn how to see the microaggressions happening in your life, either the ones you're receiving or the ones you're committing, you'll have the key to limiting their impact on you and your relationships. That's what's coming up in today's episode. Now, when it comes to building intimacy and connection, almost nothing is as important as the communication in your relationship. So if you want to improve your ability to stay connected, no matter how challenging the thing is that you're talking about, make sure that you download my free guide to my top three relationship communication secrets. These three things are fairly easy to put into practice, but they will make a huge difference in terms of your ability to handle the big topics or the little ones in ways that help you stay connected to the people that you treasure the most. To download the guide, just visit neilsatin.com/relate, or you can text the word relate to the number 33444 and follow the instructions. And if you are interested in checking out my complete Secrets of Relationship Communication course, this course covers basically all the things that you can do to transform the communication in your relationship. And it doesn't rely on your partner changing anything. They're all the leverage points that you have to improve the way that you communicate, improve your level of being understood and gotten by others, and it will help you understand others and their perspectives and find ways to bridge the gaps in understanding that can keep us disconnected when we want to stay connected. So if you want to check out the full course, just visit neilsatin.com/course, C-O-U-R-S-E, to check it out. Just a reminder that Relationship Alive is an offering for you so that you can have the best relationships possible with others and with yourself. If you are finding the show to be helpful, please consider a donation to ensure that we can continue. Every little bit helps, and you can choose whatever feels right for you. So to support the show, just visit neilsatin.com/support or text the word support to the number 33444 and follow the instructions. And this week, I would like to thank Cynthia, Julie, Alana, Maribeth, Kent, Laura, Sarah, Judith, and Dave. Thank you all so much for your generous and in many cases ongoing contributions to Relationship Alive. And finally, before we dive in, just a reminder that we have a free group on Facebook, the Relationship Alive community, where you can get support in a safe space to talk about things that are going on for you in your relationship. And if you have any questions for me, just record yourself asking the question and email it to questions@relationshipalive.com. And I will be going through the questions that get submitted to answer them here on the show. So I hope to hear from you with a good question. So go ahead, take a risk, be vulnerable, something that really matters in your life. I would love to talk to you about it. So just submit a question. And all right, that's it. Let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of Relationship Alive. This is your host, Neil Satin. There is a lot going on in the world today. And of course, there's always a lot going on in the world today. But in particular, if you've been paying any attention to the news or to the Facebook or other forms of social media, then you're aware that front and center in today's world, along with the pandemic that's going on, are issues of racial equity and justice and ways that we as a greater community can become more aware of what's happening in the world and also take action to improve our own situation and the situation of everyone around us in ways that are like a rising tide, where we all get to benefit from increased understanding and harmony and decreased acts of aggression or intolerance. And so for today's episode, I wanted to tackle a particular topic that's actually come up a bunch in the Relationship Alive community on Facebook. And I've gotten a bunch of emails about it as well. And that's the topic of microaggressions. And we're going to go into what that even means. But basically, in a nutshell, these are the subtle ways that we do violence on each other or that we receive violence. And there, and I use the word violence intentionally because I want you to recognize the importance of these things in detracting from the quality of interactions and relationships that we have with each other. But also because I think it's worth pointing out that these things are often very subtle. So they may be overt, but they may leave you or someone else with this subtle feeling that something just didn't go quite right. And we're going to dive more deeply into the topic of microaggressions, how they happen in your interactions out in the world, and in particular, how they impact your relationships with your beloved, with your partner. So in order to have this conversation today, we have one of the world's leading experts on understanding the impacts of microaggressions, or as we were, I was just saying, subtle forms of discrimination on the mental and physical health of people of color, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people, women, other marginalized groups. His name is Dr. Kevin Nadal, and he's a professor of psychology at both John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Dr. Nadal received his doctorate in counseling psychology from Columbia University. And I believe that he was he worked a lot with Daryl Dwing Su, who's also one of the world's leading researchers and authors about the topic of microaggressions. Kevin has also been featured widely in all forms of media. He was a hot topic on The View. And perhaps least importantly, although I'm really curious to know how this came about so that I can maybe get my chance, but he was named one of People Magazine's hottest bachelors in 2006. So, you know, now that I'm single, maybe Kevin can give me some pointers on how to get People Magazine's attention. In any case, we're here to have a very important conversation about the ways that you may be perpetuating racism or any sort of discrimination in your own life, in your relationships, and not even know it. Or it may be you're the recipient of it, and this will help you articulate better what's going on. And along, of course, with talking about it, we're going to talk about what to do about it. So, as usual, we will have a detailed transcript of today's conversation, which you can grab by going to neilsatin.com/micro, M-I-C-R-O, as in microaggressions. Or as always, you can text the word passion to the number 33444 and follow the instructions to download the transcript of today's show. All right, I think that's it from me. Let's get on with the show. Dr. Kevin Nadal, thank you so much for joining us here today on Relationship Alive.
Thanks, Neil. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. And we were just chatting earlier about how you're in New York, so you're in the place that was kind of pandemic central for a little while, and the numbers are coming down, so hopefully that's helping you live a slightly more easeful life in the big city with everything that's going on.
Yeah, things in New York are getting better. So hopefully day by day, we'll be back to not exactly where we used to be, but an even stronger version of what New York has always been.
Yeah, I'm right there with you for sure. So Kevin, I'm wondering, can we just dive right into, I know you probably heard my little cursory introduction of what microaggressions are, but you're the expert. So can you just summarize what is a microaggression? And I know there are a few different categories of microaggressions. So maybe we can just flesh that out for people a little bit more so that they have a sense of the kinds of things that we're talking about.
Sure. Your definition was very good. Let me just add a little bit to it. So microaggressions are the subtle, more unintentional forms of bias that might manifest between people. Oftentimes, microaggressions are things that are unconscious and that people aren't aware of them. Sometimes people are aware that they are saying or doing something but might not recognize the impact that it has on others. And microaggressions in general may have such a detrimental effect on people who experience them. I appreciate that you mentioned the idea of violence with microaggressions, because when we talk about microaggressions, we're not talking about the idea that they're so micro or they're so small that they don't have an impact. We're talking about the fact that they're sometimes so small that the accumulation of these experiences may have a detrimental impact on things such as mental health, on physical health, on even things like substance use and body image issues and educational attainment and things like that. There are several types of microaggressions that are theorized to exist. The first is called microassaults. So microassaults are the more overt forms of biases that people may participate in, but may not necessarily recognize that they have a negative impact. So they're not as overt and violent as, let's say, hate crimes or police brutality towards Black people, but they might still be intentional or overt and conscious, and that people are aware of what they're saying. So when we think about like government leaders who make blanket statements about undocumented people, calling them illegal immigrants or any other pejorative words, that would be considered a micro assault. Like, it's an assaultive term that people are using. It might not be intended to be, violent towards the communities are they're targeting, but to the communities they're targeting, it who are targeted, it definitely feels very intentional and feels very hurtful and violent. The second type of microaggression are microinsults. Microinsults are the types of behaviors and statements that people engage in that may convey biases or stereotypes that they may have about certain groups. So, for example, if a Black person gets onto an elevator and the existing people on the elevator move to their right or left or grab their purses or wallets, that's a sign of bias. A lot of times when people engage in that sort of behavior, they may not even be aware that they did it. It's so subconscious, it's so ingrained, it's so embedded in them that they engage in this behavior and don't realize the impact that it has of the person who experiences it or witnesses it. And that even though that is such a small and slight interaction, that it may have lasted all of just a few seconds, that may ruin their entire day. Or that might be something that adds to the hundreds, maybe thousands of times something like that has happened to, which may then have a negative effect on their mental health or other factors. The third type of microaggression are micro-invalidations. And what micro-invalidations are the ways that people verbally negate people's lived experiences or their truths or their realities. So for example, when somebody tells a woman, you think about your gender too much, sexism doesn't exist. When people say things like all lives matter, Black people are complaining too much. When people say things like it's all in your head, when they gaslight people, they convince other people that what their truth is actually inaccurate, when in reality it is very accurate, that these are very invalidating. And so these are the types of microaggressions that may occur oftentimes in reaction to being called out on a microaggression. So for example, if somebody overhears somebody else saying or doing something that is biased, they call them out on the microaggression, the person then denies that it actually happened. So with this, these are the three overall categories of microaggressions, and then there are different themes of how these might manifest. There are microaggressions that are related to criminality, in which people of different marginalized groups are viewed as criminals. So this might be things like people of color being followed around in stores, security guards, questioning people of color when they're shopping. It also can involve people like transgender people who are presumed to be sex workers and who police officers might target in some way and question them in similar ways because of this assumption. There are microaggressions that are related to inferiority. So sometimes this is intellectual inferiority. So sometimes a compliment towards a person of color, especially a Black person or a Latinx person, saying something like, wow, you are so articulate. Has anyone ever told you how articulate you are? That while it's a compliment and maybe intended to be something that's positive, it's actually, you know, more representative of that person's biases, that perhaps you are complimenting someone on their ability to speak standard English because you have no, or because you have biases of how you believe that certain people of color speak. And, you know, just as a last example, there are microaggressions of a perpetual foreigner, people being viewed as aliens in their own land or perpetual foreigners in their own land, which basically means that certain people of color are asked things like, where are you from? And the person says, I'm from New York. And then the person says, no, where are you really from? And the person says, I'm really from New York. And so conveying the message that this person really isn't American or couldn't possibly, you know, be from where they say because of how they appear, what their racial group is, which can be, you know, very annoying in general, but can be, you know, especially annoying if your family has been here for multiple generations and, you know, you're American as it gets and you speak as American English as possible and people still don't believe that you are part of this nation. There's a sense of that they're being communicated that they don't belong here.
Right.
So these are just a few examples.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the example that I read in your book. I think you were the editor of Microaggression Theory, Influence and Implications. And there's this example of someone saying, oh, you know, where are you from? Where are you really from? Oh, you speak English so well. And this person's like, right. Yeah, I'm from San Diego. They speak English there. Like, there's.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it is interesting because the US especially has this, on the one hand, the generation that I grew up in, we theoretically valued, I think it was more of maybe an assimilationist approach to what our world's going to be like the melting pot and we're accepting everyone. And one of our strengths is in the fact that people come from everywhere. And yet, I also grew up in Maine, where it's a pretty homogenous place. It's becoming less so these days, but you know, there weren't a lot of people who looked different than me. Now, it was interesting for me because I grew up as a Jew in a place where, like, I was the only Jew in my class and in my school. The only other one was my sister. And so there were other things that, for me anyway, personally highlighted, like, oh, this is what it's like to be a minority. But at the same time, I benefited from not being a visible minority, or at least not an obviously visible minority, which was different than, for example, the experience of there were a lot of Cambodian refugees who came to our community in the 80s. They were, you know, escaping the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. And now here are people who looked very different and came from a different world where they were experiencing extreme acts of violence there. And then suddenly, you know, they're thrust into this place where people really weren't ready in a lot of cases to truly deal with the reality of like, oh, wait a minute, like all this melting pot stuff, like here it's happening right here. Like we're trying to communicate with each other. We're trying to understand your experience. And one thing that you brought up in your descriptions that was, I figured we might as well address head on, is this sense of, I think one of the critiques that I've heard of microaggressions is that it's perpetuating kind of this like victimhood culture that like, you know, everyone's so sensitive and, you know, like, why can't we just, you know, get over things like that or just accept that like we're going to make mistakes and but it's not about people being inherently anything, inherently racist or inherently privileged or whatever it is. So it's kind of like the color blindness meets the critique of microaggression. So, you know, where do we go with that? Like is this about like turning marginalized communities into perpetual victims?
Right. You know, one of the things that really bothers me about this whole argument of victimhood is who is making that argument? It's people who come from privileged backgrounds. Uh-huh. It tends to be people who are white, who are men, who have some level of education, who probably are from at least a middle class or higher. They're probably heterosexual, they're probably cisgender. And so there's this notion that why is everyone complaining? Well, maybe people are complaining because they are experiencing these things in their everyday lives. And maybe you're thinking that, or you're labeling others as being victims because you haven't experienced these types of encounters every day in your life so much that, there's research that is empirically shown for not just microaggressions, but experiences of overt discrimination and systemic racism and all these things lead to so many different issues like health issues and educational issues and so forth. But people, because of their own personal experiences, don't view it that way. They're then in this place where they want to gaslight other people's experiences, which in itself would be a microaggression, right? So what I hope people who even entertain this idea of victimhood culture can understand is this notion of empathy, to understand that perhaps you really need to put yourself into someone else's shoes or perspectives, whatever people want to call empathy, and really try to understand why someone might be experiencing or reacting to the things that they're experiencing. When people try to negate the Black Lives Matter movement and say all lives matter, what I doubt many people are doing is empathizing with this notion that most Black people in this country fear for their lives regularly, fear for their lives of their children regularly, because it is known that Black people are killed and targeted by law enforcement. And if we don't empathize with that, if we don't take the time to read stories, to read science, and to understand what science is telling us, then we're going to continue to not really understand what's happening in our world if it's something that doesn't affect us. And so, you know, for people who are in these power positions, you know, they can continue to say whatever they want, that it's victimhood or whatnot. But for me, all I hear is that you haven't taken the time to understand a perspective that isn't your own, and that you are, you know, merely basing all of your opinions on your own perspectives without having other people that have maybe shared their own experiences, or you haven't even taken the time to learn what other people go through in their everyday lives.
Yeah. I definitely want to get back to that, because I think this is one, you know, really important question. It's how do we, the people who are kind of the most polarized against recognizing this kind of bias are the people who in some ways need it most, like need the awareness right. the most. And so, right. So I want to come back to that. But just to kind of round out our conversation about the critiques, sure. What do you think about when people who, like, at least on the surface might represent marginalized communities? I'm trying to think of the name of the person, but, you know, in other words, like a person of color who comes out and says, this is, right. you know, this is just victimhood, or this stuff doesn't exist, or these, you know, everyone needs to just like, whatever, like just get sure. their shit together and move on with things. Like when that person is obviously not coming from a place of white privilege and power, what do you think right. is going on there?
Well, I think one thing that we need to understand is that when one person who is from a certain group says something, that they're not necessarily a representative of that entire group. And in fact, totally. Sometimes those people, and sometimes what happens is that media outlets try to seek out people with those dissenting views so that they can confirm the biases that people who have those perspectives, confirm those biases with the people who have those perspectives. So when I think about, you know, people in the media, I don't even really want to say their names at all, so I won't. When they get that sort of attention, people who believe that microaggressions aren't real or believe in victimhood culture or believe in, you know, any other anti-social justice movement, you know, that just basically confirms their bias. But that's just really one person, and that there are the majority of people from historically marginalized groups don't feel this way. And how do I know that? Because we have data, we have facts, we have the ways that people vote. So when we know that 90% of Black people are voting Democratic or liberal, that's our indication that perhaps somebody who has a dissenting view is actually not representative of the entire group. For me, I personally don't try to pay attention to people that try to represent communities that they don't speak for, that they certainly have a right to share their opinions. But I think we also need to look at what majority of people in these communities actually think. Like, it would be illogical to say that the Logan Republicans represent the LGBTQ community. We know that majority of LGBTQ folks are liberal and are pro-social justice and pro-equity. And so, you know, sometimes we pay too much attention to people that are actually the dissenters who are minorities of the actual community. And I think that there's a responsibility for the media to stop that. That we need to not give people these platforms because they're perpetuating false narratives than what actually the community is. And you know, your original question is what do we do about this, or why do they? I forgot how you phrased it, but my answer is perhaps they have their own internalized oppression that they've learned from however long they've had these beliefs. That their group is bad in some way. So this happens. There's research on it. There's empirical research on this, that people of color learn to hate themselves, that people of LGBTQ experience learn to internalize negative messages about what it means to be LGBTQ, that women internalize sexism and so forth. And so what happens then is that when people do internalize these messages, then they lash out, and they might even turn against people in their own groups. And it's not necessarily that they are representative of any group or of the group in general, but rather that they might have a lot of hatred towards themselves and towards their own groups.
Yeah. Kevin, we need to just take a quick break so I can mention this week's sponsor. If you are looking for some extra support around the things that get in the way of your happiness or achieving your goals or improving your communication or overcoming the impacts of microaggressions in your life, one great way that you can do that from the comfort of your own home or office or anywhere really is BetterHelp. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can chat via text with your counselor at any time, and you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, all without having to go anywhere. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. They also offer a broad range of expertise so that you can find the person most suited to helping you with your own unique situation. In fact, because so many people are using BetterHelp, they are actually recruiting additional counselors in all 50 of the US states. So whether it's depression, stress, anxiety, your relationship, trauma, anger, family conflicts, whatever is up for you, try out BetterHelp to help you move past the places where you're stuck. To start living a happier life today, you can try BetterHelp and get an extra 10% off your first month as a Relationship Alive listener. Just visit betterhelp.com/alive and join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, help.com/alive. And thank you so much, BetterHelp, for your support of our mission here on Relationship Alive. And now let's get back to our conversation. I think too that, you know, anytime you stray from the data, and let's just admit that there's been an interesting assault going on against facts and science and truth. Right. And, you know, we could do a whole, you know, that would probably be like the gaslighting episode or something like that.
Right.
I suppose it's possible that any of these people, could have had like what they could be one of those people who just like for whatever fortunate reason, I'm putting fortunate in quotes, like maybe they didn't experience anything that they ever identified as bias in their lives. Maybe they did have, you know, if they're straying from data, then they're either just making shit up or they're speaking from their experience, and their experience could just be the experience of this one person. And as you pointed out, not relate to like the much broader kinds of experiences that people are generally having.
Right. And that could be their experience. And that's definitely their truth. And what I mentioned earlier is that they might just need to empathize with why other people might not have that experience. So even when people of historically marginalized groups themselves publicly talk about victimhood culture, you know, I start to question, you know, why are they so adamant about this? If they know that people of their groups, and especially if majority of people their groups experience these forms of discrimination and, you know, have negative reactions to these experiences of discrimination, like why are they so adamant of denying that exists? Why not examine perhaps that you're lucky that these things didn't happen to you, that you know, you're actually an outlier, you're fortunate to not have experienced these things. And you know, similarly to what I had mentioned in general, is that just to empathize, like what do we have to gain by denying people of what their reality is, you know? And maybe perhaps if these folks had, you know, more opportunities to learn about the true realities of the world and about systemic oppression through, you know, ethnic studies classes and gender studies classes and queer studies classes, perhaps, you know, they would have been introduced to a different line of thinking than simply relying on either their own experiences or what, you know, historic mainstream educational systems try to push on us, that, you know, to be colorblind or to not think about difference and to focus mostly on the positive and all those things, which are very ideal. But the truth is that we don't live in that world. We live in a world that's very oppressive. We live in a country in which certain groups are able to thrive and other groups continue to suffer. And so why be so adamant about denying other people's experiences? You know, I'll just use myself as an example. You know, I have a lot of historically marginalized groups, which I talk about a lot, but I also have, am part of a lot of historically privileged groups as a person without disabilities, as a person who is generally a cisgender male, as a person who now has educational access and has, you know, even some, socioeconomic status that's, you know, rising. Like, why would I want to be like an asshole to people who have these, you know, these historically marginalized groups? Like, why would I ever say to a person living with a disability, like, you know, it's not really that hard if you just, you know, get your act together, you know, you could,
right?
You know, why would I do that? Like, and why wouldn't I just be able to see, like, wow, you are a person with a disability. That means that there are going to be so many challenges that you have just by having that disability and living in a world that wasn't built for you, or living in a world that makes it harder for you to be able to just be yourself and to live your life. Like, why would I deny that? Right. Like, similarly with women, like as a cisgender man, why would I ever say, like, you know, sexual assault isn't real? I've never experienced that. Like, and I don't worry about being sexually assaulted when I walk down the street. So why would I deny that that happens? And especially if I have data to know that one out of every five women is sexually assaulted, in their lifetime, or one in every 6 seconds that a woman is sexually assaulted. Like, why, if we know that this is a reality, like, why would I deny that? So it's just, you know, really reflecting on, you know, your own experiences and just being empathetic, like knowing that, you know, this is the reality. Like, I can't deny that Black people and transgender people and women and Native Americans and all these other groups are people, there are going to be obstacles that they experience because they live in a world that was not made for them, or they live in a world that continues to make their lives harder. For whatever reason. I just want to be that person that tries to support others, to understand others, uplift others, do whatever I can to make the world a more equitable place for all.
Yeah, there are a few different things kind of coalescing together in my brain at the moment. One of them being, this is just kind of my own pet theory, so I don't necessarily yep. have data to support this, but my pet sure. theory is that in general, people are doing kind of the best that they can, and that they operate from a frame of reference that they're a good person. In fact, I think there's a behavioral science term for this, but basically it's like assuming the best of yourself and assuming the worst of other people. And right. And so when someone is confronted with something that they've done that someone else has experienced as hurtful or derogatory or what have sure. you, that they have to confront their own sense of like an internal emotional collapse, which for the perpetrator, you know, to use a strong term of a microaggression or a macroaggression, like they have to recognize that they themselves aren't perfect. And then they have to right. deal with whatever level of shame or like whatever emotions come up for them in that moment. That my guess is that those emotions become huge obstacles to them being able to meet the world with empathy, as you're pointing out.
Right. And that's, you know, that's real. Now, this is just this idea of people become really defensive. That's a natural inclination to become defensive when anything is challenged about yourself. And so, you know, I acknowledge all the time that people to be defensive is to be human. And there's also so much that we can allow that defensiveness to continue, especially if we're people that are presented with new knowledge, that perhaps even if we think we're good people, that if we perpetuate certain things, that we're actually not being good people. If we, you know, ignore the racial injustices that happen in the world, the injustices against other historically marginalized communities too, then you're actually not a great person, because you, you know, are actively trying to deny based on, even though there is science and research that supports that these things do exist, that you're actively trying to ignore those things. And so, you know, this is part of the process, and this is why it's so important for people to do this reflective work. It's so important for people to come to terms with some of the harsh realities of our world. And part of that comes with understanding the ways that people have benefited from power and privilege. Part of this, you know, comes from actually educating oneself, whether it's through school or reading or documentaries or any number of things. And then part of these comes from learning from lived experiences. I think if people had more exposure to people that were different than them, that they might get it a little bit more. You know, there's a theory that, you know, there's a lot of questions about it, but I think in its core, there might be at least some truth to it, and it's called contact theory. And the contact theory says is that the more exposure that people have to people of other groups, the more understanding and empathy they might have with those groups. And, you know, if we just think about this from, you know, very personal practical experiences, you know, LGBTQ rights are still fairly new. Even though Stonewall happened now 50 years ago, 51 years ago, LGBTQ rights are very new. Same-sex marriage was not legal in the United States until 5 years ago. And so many people were very overt about their anti-LGBTQ biases or beliefs that they may have had. They still are, many still are, but the times have changed, and their Pew Research Center finds every year that number switches. It used to be that majority were anti-LGBTQ people, and now majority people are pro-LGBTQ people. And part of that is that people have just been exposed to more LGBTQ people. More people are coming out. More people are coming out in families that say that they've never had any LGBTQ people, but they've always been there. They just never came out. More people are being exposed to LGBTQ people in their workplace. Again, they've always been there, but now they're out or starting to come out. And so that starts to change our belief systems. And so, you know, when people say things like all lives matter, you know, I ask them like, okay, well, how many Black people are in your life in meaningful ways? You know, a lot of times people will say like, well, I have a coworker who's Black. Okay, well, how often do you interact with that person? Do you have them over to your house for dinner? Do you talk to them about their racial justice or racial experiences and their thoughts about racial justice? And if they say no, then, you know, that's very telling to me, because it says that, you know, there's some, on some level, like there is, there's some reason why you don't have people of in this case, people of color or Black people in your life. And what is that about? And so for you all to do that reflection so that you can start to the process of understanding what people's, you know, experiences are. And when I say this, I definitely do not mean go out and find the first Black friend you could find, because that actually would be horrible. It's to question that and then to organically, you know, think about ways that you can have exposure to people that are different from you, without tokenizing them, without exoticizing them, without, you know, making them do extra work for you. But you know, again, I think it takes like some reflection on, you know, why is it that you don't have this level of exposure to difference in your life?
Right. There are a couple different things coming to mind right now. One being that, you know, I'm going to make a generalization, which is that most people who are listening to us are at least operating from a growth mindset. Like if you're here listening to me and Kevin, you care about this stuff and you want to be part of the solution. And so for probably a lot of these people, and I'm thinking about in the microaggression theory book, there were kind of these different categories of like where people fall in the spectrum of,
yep,
of how they respond to microaggressions. Yep. And there's everything from the people who are insensitive and afraid, and those are the people who kind of meet conversations about this or being called out with defensiveness and anger and, sure, and perhaps, and most likely even more microaggressions.
Sure.
You know, there are any number of conversations on Facebook that I've had that would fall into that,
yep,
category. But then there are people, sure, who are empathetic, but don't necessarily know. I think it's called like the empathic but unaccountable type, where, mm-hmm, it's like they get it, but they don't really know quite how to engage in the conversation in ways that someone who's anti-racist and is learning how to engage in these kind of conversations and willing to fail might be able to engage in the conversation. So there is like that spectrum of, you know, how people who are trying to figure out what the heck is going on and who are trying to learn from people who are experiencing microaggressions, or who might be like trying to extrapolate their own experience of microaggressions,
right,
onto other communities, like that in and of itself is an evolution. And then there's like, and then there's like, okay, and what do you do with the like generally I'm like, I support this stuff, but I don't know how to deal with the people who are just like incessant, whatever I say, however I try to approach it with them, they're just going to gaslight me and be angry. Sure. And I think this comes into, you know, at the beginning of our conversation, we mentioned how this might impact people's interpersonal relationships. So maybe this would be a good moment to like bring that in as well before we kind of wrap it all up. Because, you know, we're talking about this in terms of the societal level, but within a couple, there are any number of opportunities for one person to do subtle things that undermine their partner and undermine the connection between them.
Sure. I mean, you know, we could probably talk about this for hours, but to think about some of the key points that I would make are, you know, one is this idea that to be committed to fighting against microaggressions is not just, you know, how to respond to microaggressions, but it's also just how can I actively engage in fighting against injustice in every single part of my life? It's to know that you can engage in addressing microaggressions that happen in the workplace or in families, but it's also to learn more and to be educated about the various ways that our systems are oppressive. It's to learn how to teach our children to disrupt societal norms like gender role norms and body image issues and skin color issues and all these other things that children learn from a very early age. It means, you know, calling people out and calling people in, correcting people on language that might be offensive or hurtful in ways that are effective. So, you know, being able to say like, oh, what do you mean by that? When they say a term that you may not necessarily agree with, and then maybe saying like, oh, I don't know if you know, but certain people might find that word offensive. So you're doing so in a way where you're not shaming them, but rather trying to educate them. For me, a big part of it is also just, you know, reminding people that this is not just a moment in time where people are just caring about racial justice, but this is a movement. This is something that we're actively trying to do to change our world. If we really care about people of historically marginalized groups, in this case right now, if we really care about Black people and Black lives, then we have to disrupt anti-Blackness at every level, like from the books that children are learning and reading, the way the media images that we have on television, and then on top of that, the systemic things like police brutality and voters' rights and all those sorts of things. But back to your question about within interpersonal relationships, to really recognize that there are definitely microaggressions that can occur in romantic relationships. We would hope there would be none, because in a romantic relationship, it is hoped that this person is either your most intimate person or someone that, you know, you trust and love and support so much. But this is the problem with microaggressions. Microaggressions are so incessant that because of these socialized, internalized beliefs that we've all learned somehow, that they can manifest even among your most interpersonal, intimate relationships. Some of these ways might be more obvious. Like, so for example, in interracial romantic relationships, lots of microaggressions can occur. Things that partners might say, especially white partners might say to their partners of color, that might be obviously embedded in some sort of racial bias. So that's obviously there. When it comes to heterosexual relationships, there are lots of ways in which sexist microaggressions occur that many people may not even label as microaggressions, at least not initially, because it's so embedded into our society. So for example, gender role norms are a prime example of microaggressions that occur towards women. And so when we presume that women are going to cook or clean, when we presume that men are going to drive all the time and that women aren't supposed to drive, or any number of stereotypes or biases that people have, and those are brought into the relationship, that could be considered a microaggression. It could be that the woman doesn't care or doesn't say anything, which is very, you know, real. And part of that, it might be because she herself has internalized these gender role norms herself. But if she does care, then this might be an issue that comes up a lot, in which men might be, their male partners might be challenged on the ways that his sexism, both overt sexism as well as subtle microaggressive sexism, may impact their relationship. And it's not just with heterosexual couples, with same-sex couples, couples with where there's at least one transgender or gender non-conforming partner. These sorts of things might happen as well. Like, there's definitely a chance for a cisgender partner who has a transgender partner to enact some form of transphobic bias in their relationship. One of the most common things that comes out in research with transgender women who have heterosexual cisgender male partners are things like that the cisgender male partners will, you know, be sexually involved with their transgender girlfriends, but they won't want to take them out in public, or they don't want to tell their friends about them. And so that could be a really hurtful thing that happens to their relationship, where, you know, they're seeing each other sexually and perhaps in private, but he's not proud to be seen with her in public. And that is very much a hurtful, you know, microaggression that occurs. Mm-hmm. And even with same-sex couples, that same-sex couples who, you know, presumably are of the same gender, that they might engage in a lot of different microaggressions that are based on their own internalized homophobia, biphobia, or heterosexism in general, meaning that, you know, some of the arguments that they might have, some of the conflicts that they might have, might be based, again, on some of these gender role norms. Like, a lot of times I'll see same-sex male couples in which one is traditionally more masculine, one is traditionally more feminine, and it's expected that the feminine one does more housework or does more of the feminine types of stereotype feminine types of things, which again can cause lots of conflicts in that relationship. Even with, when it comes to like feelings, and I know this is something that you talk about on your podcast a lot, how to communicate and feelings, a lot of gay or queer men in relationships with other men, you know, they've internalized these gender role norms of toxic masculinity just as much as heterosexual men have. And so sometimes they have difficulty expressing their feelings, or they might resort to anger instead of talking through, you know, any of the feelings that they might have. So that, you know, those might be a little bit beyond microaggressions, but when those sorts of arguments lead to the perpetuation of gender role norms, you know, then we're looking at the ways that, you know, their internalized homophobia or internalized biases in general, you know, now affects the relationship. So,
right.
You know, so what I would just say is, in a nutshell, is just that people just need to question and challenge, you know, any parts of their relationships, and to think to themselves, is there a possibility that gender is involved in this conflict? Is there a possibility that race or sexual orientation or social class is involved? That's another one that you see in romantic relationships. Social class, the expectation that people want to do something, but maybe somebody doesn't have the capacity or the means to do something and the other one does. That's a social class expectation, which then can manifest into some sort of microaggression. Religious differences that happen. There's lots of microaggressions that could happen in those types of relationships as well.
Right. It's, I think overall, I like where you got with that, which is this, the ability in any moment to be able to step back from whatever situation is happening and to say, like, is what's happening right here, like, could you, like, what happens when you look at this situation through the lens of, like, a power imbalance, to use like a word that, you know, seems to be woven through all of the isms, right? It's like, who has power and who doesn't in a particular moment. And to be able to say, like, what is the power dynamic that's at play here? And then to find a way with your partner, or if you're out in the world, in the workplace, et cetera, to find a way to bridge the gap with that person, to invite them. And I think that's kind of the calling in versus calling out that you mentioned a few right. moments ago. It's like, how do you invite that person into the conversation with you so that if right. you inadvertently, you know, if you want to do something and your partner doesn't, and when you step back from it, you're like, oh, that's because like, for me, like I came from a upper middle class family where spending money on whatever is not a big deal, and they didn't. And yeah. so it's a bigger issue for them. Like, how can I bring that, or vice versa, right? Because it may be that you realize that that's why you're feeling hurt or fearful or whatever it is about this particular situation, to be able to say to the other person, like, hey, can we talk about this? And would you be willing to look at this situation through this particular lens with me?
Yeah.
I mean, that's one way that that just kind of occurs to me, that you might have more luck not triggering someone else's defensiveness or their shame about wherever they come from, and be able to actually enter into the dialogue with them.
Right.
I think that's the hardest thing in the interpersonal, like in the romantic relationships, is because at the core, you love this person and they hurt you, or you hurt them. Right. And you somehow like have to deal with that. But I mean, as a coach to couples, I see this all the time, you know, where one of them inadvertently hurts the other person or says something that represents some assumption that they have. And it can be really challenging to get both people back to their curiosity, where they can be like, oh, what's really going on here? And how do we get at it while we don't forget that, you know, deep down we care about each other? And I even think that's true for like coworkers or what have you, that like we wanna get along ultimately. I mean, there are some people who seem to just want to be assholes, but for the most part, I think we all just kind of want to be able to get along with each other, but we're gonna have to get through these moments of where we've broken the trust between people and find our way back to connecting in those moments.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I just want to add to that, I think everything you said is right on target.
Yeah, please.
And everything that you're saying, or at least in this example right here, is like, you know, how do we deal with this when conflict arises? Which in reality is just, it's like, how are we reacting to this conflict and then trying to reflect on, you know, how this power imbalance might occur in this situation. And I also challenge people to do some proactive work. So before any conflict arises, can you talk about how power might influence, you know, everything about you as a couple, or in the case of friends or coworkers, anything about your friendship, so that when a conflict occurs, that it wouldn't be coming out of nowhere, that you will already have had some introductory conversations about these issues. You know, I think for some couples, this has to happen right away. So if you have couples of different religious backgrounds, you tend to have those conversations right away. Different racial groups, you tend to have those conversations right away. But a lot of times, like with heterosexual couples, we don't talk about, or they don't talk about, I shouldn't say we, it's definitely not we, they don't talk about those issues of gender and sexism at the start of their relationship, because that they've never had to, because that's just been the presumption that men and women are, when they get together, like there are other things to worry about, that's the norm to be, you know, in this couple, that's just a norm. But also for queer couples, there's this presumption that because you're both queer or the same sex, that you don't have to worry about any other dynamic either. But there are still going to be dynamics that occur because of your own, you know, lived experiences and identities and, you know, all these other internalized beliefs that we all have. And so to not just react to conflict, but also to be proactive before conflict even occurs.
Yeah, I love that suggestion. So important. And that way, yeah, like you said, at least you have kind of the background of having either had those conversations successfully, or maybe even having tried to have those conversations, because I could see those being challenging conversations to have, to just kind of lay all that bare.
Right.
When a conflict comes up, or when you're looking for support from a third party, you have the fabric of like, yeah, we're aware of these things, or these are the things we've talked right. about. Even if you miss some things and someone kind of looking in from the outside says, well, have you ever talked about the fact that you come from this background and you come from this other background, and you know, you can hear that without it triggering your defensiveness, or should it trigger your defensiveness, you recognize that's what's happening, and you go through all those important tools of regrounding yourself and coming back to who you
right.
to your centered place, so that you can have those conversations.
Right. You know, and as we talk about this, like, you know, I wonder why some people don't have these conversations from the very start. Like, why isn't this part of your dating process? Like, you know, could this be something that when you choose your partner, that you're already thinking about how they feel
totally.
About social justice? You know, again, that's something that's important to me. Maybe it's not something important to people right away, but maybe that should be something that we at least think about when we start dating and getting to know somebody before they become our primary romantic partner.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, I was just kind of laughing because, you know, still for so many people, I think that entry point into relationship is just like, I'm attracted to you, we have fun
right.
together, let's have sex,
yep.
you know, it's like all of those things. And then afterwards, there's like the, whoa, wait a minute, like, who are you? And
right.
how did we get here?
right.
And, you know, yes, I totally agree with you that there's so many opportunities to really know the person before you have to be doing damage control.
Right, absolutely.
Well, Kevin, absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation today. It's so important, one that I think we could easily talk about for another hour or two. I'm wondering, you know, what's current for you? What's going on? Where you mentioned before I hit the record button that you have a new book that's out, and yeah, if people want to find out more about your work and where your passion lies at this moment, what's going on?
Sure, thank you. So I have a new book that just came out. It's called Queering Law and Order, LGBTQ Communities in the Criminal Justice System. It's a book that describes the history of LGBTQ people in government and law. So outlining things such as police brutality, experiences in prisons, experiences with immigration system, and so forth. It just came out. It's one of the first books to really cover these topics in this comprehensive way. So I hope that you could either buy it yourself or to suggest your libraries to pick it up, and also just to, you know, to learn more about LGBTQ communities and criminal justice in general.
Absolutely. Well, that's definitely sounds like something worth checking out. And just in general, Kevin, I've really enjoyed having you in the show, and I hope that that we can have you back at some point to talk even more.
Sure.
As I mentioned at the beginning, if you want a transcript of today's episode, we've certainly covered a broad range of topics. Just visit neilsatin.com/micro, or you can text the word passion to the number 33444 and follow the instructions. And I will also have links to Kevin Nadal's website and to his books, the one that he just named, on Queering Law and Order, and also the book that I mentioned earlier, Microaggression Theory, Influence and Implications. I think, Kevin, you've written like 9 or 10 books at this point, right? So,
Yeah. So just choose your favorite books to highlight.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Kevin. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Take care. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Relationship Alive. If you like what you've heard and want to make it easier for other people to find out about us, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast and to rate and review us on iTunes. If you have questions or comments or want to continue the conversation, you can always join our Relationship Alive community Facebook group. And for more information about today's episode, visit us online at neilsatin.com/podcast. Or you can always text the word passion, P-A-S-S-I-O-N, to the number 33444 for more information. Finally, do you have a burning question that you're hoping we can have answered here on Relationship Alive, either for a future or past guest? Let me know and I'll see what I can do. Take care and see you next time.